Where are we so far? Last time I was talking about these dramatic changes in the international system that took place, in the period right after the turn of the 20th century, you know, like 1900 to 1906 or so. What was the basic point there? It's that in the 1890s, you had a certain formlessness of international politics. Or to put it somewhat differently, you had these three great blocs: the Austro-German alliance, the Franco-Russian alliance, and then the British Empire. And they existed in a sort of uneasy relationship with each other. Relations between the Austro-German side and the Franco-Russian side, they're not all that good because of those fundamental conflicts that divided those two blocks of powers. But they weren't all that bad either because continental issues, purely European issues, were in the background. And during this period of the 1890s, overseas issues, colonial issues, imperial issues lay at the heart of international political life. You see, Fashoda in 1898, or intervention against the Boxers in China in 1900, Boer War from 1899 to 1902. That's what grabbed people's attention. Right? Relations between Britain and each of these two continental blocs were also not very good. And there are a lot of people in Britain who are worried that all the continental powers would form a bloc, a continental bloc against Britain. Right? So British policy lay at the heart of the story here. You know, which way would Britain go? Would Britain maintain a free hand, a policy of balancing between the two continental blocs in the expectation that their divisions were so great that they would never really be able to kind of come together against Britain, right? And that in fact, each of them had a certain interest in the maintenance of Britain as a counterweight to their continental rivals. Each of them afraid that if they pushed Britain too hard, Britain would abandon the policy of the free hand and commit herself to their continental adversaries, right? Could Britain maintain the policy of the free hand, trusting in those dynamics, those kind of power political dynamics? And there were people, especially Lord Salisbury, Prime Minister, and until the year 1900, still Foreign Secretary, who thought that Britain could retain the free hand. But increasingly, Salisbury was isolated, and prevailing opinion in the cabinet. Don't forget, Britain has a cabinet government. It's not like the Prime Minister or the Foreign Secretary simply lays down the law and everyone goes along with it. Within the cabinet, Salisbury is very much of a minority. And most people in the cabinet felt like Britain would have to abandon the policy of so-called isolation, the policy of the free hand. Okay? That Britain would have to commit herself to one or the other continental blocs. Right? So which way would Britain go? Retain the free hand, side with Germany and Austria, or side with Russia and France. Right? And it's very important to note when you're trying to assess the kind of argument that people like Mearsheimer make, that the whole instinct of the British was to make some sort of deal with Germany. You know, and so you had these overtures to the Germans in the period from 1898 through 1901. And it's the Germans who spurn these overtures. The British are particularly sensitive to the need to kind of break out of their isolation because of events in South Africa, because of the Boer War, because it seemed that all the continental countries were sympathetic with the Boers, and there was, it seemed like maybe there was this danger that they would intervene against Britain. You know, this Britain's inability, it seemed, to develop really friendly and close relations with any of the major continental countries was not a very pleasant thing. So there were these overtures to the Germans, and the Germans basically say no. Okay. You know, it's like, to a certain extent, it was a question of different judgments about who needed whom. The British thought that Germany needed Britain more than Britain needed Germany, because ultimately continental issues would rise to the top of the political agenda. It's on the continent that these countries had really vital interests, basic interests, interests relating to their survival and their political freedom. Right? Germany needed Britain to kind of hold the ring against Russia, especially Russia supported by France. So the British felt they could hold out. The Germans, on the other hand, looked at the situation and thought that, you know, you didn't have to worry about the continent so much anymore, and basically these imperial questions were the most salient ones. And since Britain was under pressure from France and Russia, it was Britain who needed Germany, and Britain should pay a price in terms of promoting Germany's own colonial aspirations. So, you know, but that turned out, of course, to be an optical illusion. And that was one key element in the problem, but deeper than that, you had this really visceral dislike that was growing between these two peoples, between the Germans and the British. So much so that the Anglo-German antagonism, which was developing during this period, moved front and center and became the key force driving international politics in this period before the First World War, right? And how that happened and what its consequences were, that's what we're going to be talking about next time. Right? So the British had tried with Germany. Those efforts had failed, and by 1901, the British had really turned against the Germans. You look at what the British are saying about the Germans in these, you know, private documents. Very, very negative view. And they had tried also to improve relations with France and Russia, right? Partly to avoid too much dependence on Germany. But the French and the Russians, seeing how isolated the British were because of the poor quality of their relations with Germany, felt that they could push ahead. They didn't have to reach these accommodations. They didn't have to be conciliatory to the British. They, especially, this is the case with regard to Russia. You know, if France moved ahead in Africa, there was a lot of water between France and Africa, and British naval power could be brought into play. But if Russia moved ahead in northern China, in fact, toward Korea, then there wasn't much the British Navy could do about it. And these developments in northern China, Russian expansionists in northern China, were a central concern for the British. And how did they try to meet this general problem? Given their failure to develop friendly relations with either of the major continental blocs, well, they looked elsewhere. They looked toward Japan. I should say also this was a key factor leading to the dramatic improvement in Anglo-American relations during this period. But for our purposes, the conclusion of the Anglo-Japanese alliance in 1902 was a key part of this story. Okay. What are we to make of this alliance? There was no warmth in it from the British side. It was a very cold alliance. Right. They didn't promise to help Japan in the event of war, simply to remain neutral in the event that Japan went to war against Russia. They only promised that they would hold the line for Japan, that if another European power entered the war, namely France, Russia's ally, or Germany, which was trying to cozy up to Russia during this period, then Britain would enter in, but only then. As a matter of fact, Britain fully expected that Japan would lose against Russia. But that was not a problem for the British, because the Russians would never be able to conquer the Japanese home islands. And as long as there was a resentful, defeated, humiliated Japan in Russia's flank, you know, Japan would, in that case, serve as a sort of counterweight to Russian power in that area. So you have Japan, you know, fortified by this alliance with the British, going to war against Russia, and achieving these really spectacular victories, especially the victory at sea, the battle of the Tsushima Strait, where the Russian fleet, having kind of come halfway around the world, was simply utterly destroyed by the Japanese Navy. Very important world historical event in terms of relations between the Third World and the Europeans. So Russia's frustrated in East Asia. But the important thing to note is that even while this war was going on, this war between Britain's ally, Japan, and Russia's and France's ally, Russia, Britain and France came together in a very famous agreement, the Anglo-French Entente, it was called, of 1904. A lot more important than the Japanese thing, because this involved the very structure of European politics. You know, this was a very important development in the story that would have, you know, really major long-term consequences, the Anglo-French Entente. What did the Anglo-French Entente provide for? Well, there was an agreement. The Anglo-French Agreement of 1904 over all of these overseas issues. And this agreement covered a whole slew of problems where British and French imperial interests had collided over the years. Some of these problems went back centuries, like a dispute over the fishing banks off the coast of Newfoundland, you know, conflicts in West Africa, over in the area of the Gambia, for example. But the heart of the agreement, the heart of the Anglo-French agreement, was a deal involving the two countries at the opposite sides of North Africa, Morocco and Egypt, right? The British had moved into Egypt in 1882. French never liked that. This is what drove Britain and France apart. This was the taproot of the Fashoda crisis of 1898, because the French had wanted to kind of move into the Sudan and get control over the headwaters of the Nile so that they can control Lower Egypt or exercise some influence over Lower Egypt. Right. This was a big bone of contention between France and Britain. And now basically the French agreed to recognize the British as predominant in Egypt, basically to support the British position. Yeah. And in exchange for that, the British agreed to do the same thing for the French in Morocco. Now Morocco was an independent state. Morocco's sovereignty and independence had been recognized by the European powers at a conference held in Madrid in 1880. The Act of Madrid, you know, basically promised that the independence of Morocco would be respected. But the French wanted to penetrate Morocco. They were dreaming of a greater France on both sides of the Mediterranean. They had occupied Algeria in 1830, and there were a lot of French settlers in Algeria. They had taken over Tunisia in 1879, I think it was. And they wanted to round out their control of what was called the Maghreb by taking over Morocco as well, penetrating into Morocco. Right? The British were sensitive to that. because of the strategic importance of Morocco, you know, so close to the Straits of Gibraltar, and, you know, and control of the Mediterranean, access to the Mediterranean through the Suez Canal to India. That was Britain's lifeline. And for the French to entrench themselves in Morocco, this is a problem for the British. But now the British felt like they could accept French predominance in Morocco, providing the strategic important strip of territory. The very northern part of Morocco was given to a weak power, namely it was given to Spain. But basically, the British would agree to provide what they call diplomatic support for the French in Morocco. Why is this agreement important? On the face of it, you say, well, the British are just settling colonial conflicts. They're settling disputes. How can anyone argue against that? They're reaching accommodations. They're overextended. They want to strengthen their position by reducing the level of conflict with at least one major European power. You know, why on earth would anyone object to this? The answer is that this agreement was not simply a colonial agreement. The answer is that this agreement had implications with regard to the structure of great power politics as a whole. It meant that Britain was siding with France, and implicitly siding against Germany. Right? It would have all kinds of implications with regard to Britain's relations with Russia. Because if Britain had good relations with France, Russia's ally, this would in effect be a bridge to good relations with Russia. You can see why France would want something like this, bringing Britain into close relations with her would make France, you know, to use Bismarck's expression, one of three. And a Europe of five great powers, the key thing was to be one of three. Now France would be not just one of three, but the pivotal member of a bloc of three powers, you know, with good relations both with Russia and with Britain, better than the relations that either Britain or, you know, that Britain and Russia had with each other, certainly. Right? You can understand why the French would be reaching for this. It's not a pure security argument. This is a way of increasing French power, French leverage, so as to support a more active French policy, especially a policy of overseas expansion. This is not simply security, not simply status quo oriented. And also had the effect of diluting France's dependence on Russia. As a matter of fact, the French made it clear to the British in the course of these negotiations that if Britain got itself involved in a conflict with Russia, there was a very good chance that France would stay out of it. All right, so it has this kind of a larger meaning. You can understand why the French would go for it. What about the British? Why would anyone in Britain oppose this sort of thing? Because it too, you know, had major implications with regard to Britain's relations with all the, you know, major continental powers, and in particular with Germany. The more you move to one side of the divide in Europe, the more dependent you become on your friends, and the worse your relations are with your adversaries. And there are a lot of people in Britain, you know, declining influence, but still substantial. People like Lord Salisbury and the top permanent official in the British Foreign Office during the Salisbury period, his name was Sanderson, Lord Sanderson, they didn't like this drift of British policy at all. Because you could say, oh, well, yes, on the surface of it, the British weren't committing themselves to much. They simply promised that they would provide France with diplomatic support. They would provide France with diplomatic support in the event that France got in trouble over her penetration of Morocco. But this didn't mean military support. This is the army. But it's important to see that implicit in that fundamental policy choice was the decision to opt for France against Germany. To support France, no matter what the Germans said. It wasn't as though the British said, look, we'll support you in the case of Morocco, but you better take care to make sure the Germans do not object to what you're doing. Right? The British had given up a policy of balancing between France and Germany, balancing between the continental blocs. Britain was siding with one side. Again, a lot of this stuff is just kind of implicit. But you can see it becoming explicit at the time of the first Moroccan crisis in 1905-1906. I mean, you could also see the whole tenor of British thinking that was taking hold at this time. The view was taking hold that there was something peculiarly wrong with Germany and with German ambitions, and that you couldn't accommodate Germany. You know? Every other power, France, Russia, their interests might collide with Britain. You know? But there's a kind of legitimacy to what they were doing. You could accept it. Germany asked for things. Oh no, it wasn't legitimate at all. Germany was an extortionist. Germany was a blackmailer. When Germany did exactly the same sorts of things that everyone else did. You know, everyone else said, look, you want us to cooperate with you in Egypt? Fine, but you gotta give us something in exchange. Perfectly normal in international politics, it's just a deal. But not the case in Germany. The British wanted to have certain reforms in Egypt. It was called the Khedivial Decree. The Khedive of Egypt was like the Sultan of Egypt. He was to promulgate certain reforms, but the Egyptian situation was a little complex in legal terms, and the British had to get the other powers of Europe to go along with this. And they had, you know, in effect, they bought off France by agreeing to support French claims in Morocco. They bought off Russia even by making concessions to Russia in Tibet. They bought off even Italy by agreeing to make concessions to what Italy wanted in Ethiopia. But when Germany asked for the same kind of thing, Lansdowne, British Foreign Secretary, you know, said, this is a great act of effrontery. And in fact, you see a very striking shift taking place in British official thinking in this period. A very dramatic shift from Salisbury to Lansdowne, and especially a shift taking place among the permanent officials in the British Foreign Office. That's why I gave you this famous Eyre Crowe memorandum to read. You'll be reading it for next week. It'll enable you to see how what was becoming the dominant clique in British foreign policy making approached the situation. It's like all black and white. Britain stands for everything that's good. Germany stands for everything that's bad. Just read you some of these things. It's just kind of incredible. I mean, the kind of language that's used, this kind of reference to the relentless vindictiveness of Germany. What else? When talking about Germany, it refers to an entirely one-sided aggressiveness. Refers to Germany as a blackmailer, whereas Britain stands for the interests of all humanity. You know, everything that Britain wants is for the general good. And not only that, but he has a theory of why this is the case. He says it all has to do with British naval preeminence. Say, given the importance of naval power, everyone else is bound to be very concerned about how Britain is exercising it. because naval power, naval preeminence, gives Britain a stranglehold over everybody. And so the only way that Britain can get countries to not gang up against her and to accept British naval preeminence is by pursuing a very responsible policy, a policy that harmonizes with the interests of all mankind. And Britain stands for the freedom of oppressed nationalities and so on. You can imagine how people in India or in Ireland or throughout the British Empire would react to this. You know, this is just hypocrisy. This is just cant. But it reflects this mentality. You could see that this is not cold, rational, power political calculation here. The British policy has an emotional taproot. There's something emotional going on in terms of Britain's relations with Germany. Rational policy would be, sure, improve relations with France and Russia. You always profit by having friends, as many friends and as few enemies as possible, but avoid antagonizing Germany. Because if you antagonize Germany, you'll be the slave of your allies. You know, there's always a price to pay when you alienate a country. Right? British are kind of losing sight of that. As a matter of fact, if you look at the volume of documents that this Crowe Memorandum is taken from, the very next document in that volume was a response to it from Lord Sanderson, who was in the Salisbury School, basically arguing against it. You know, it's like, no, things are not to be understood in such black and white, simple terms. Right? So you have this drift of British policy. They're not quite at the conscious level under Lansdowne. It becomes much more conscious. The anti-German emphasis becomes much more pronounced under Lansdowne's successor, Sir Edward Grey, who was Foreign Secretary in the Liberal government that came to power shortly after the Entente was worked out. Okay. Germany's reaction to this. Germany's reaction. They don't like it one bit. They understand or they sense what the larger implications are. You know, it's framed as just a settlement of Anglo-French colonial differences. The Germans know that it has meaning in the European political. And the Kaiser says, it cannot be denied that England underhandedly is working to isolate us. So that's what William II says in 1904, right after the Entente was signed. And the Germans are beginning to talk about encirclement, the German term Einkaisung, very, very commonly used during this period. The Germans have been encircled. You know, I called the lecture last time the end of British isolation. Maybe I should call it the beginning of German isolation, because this is the beginning of the forging of a ring around Germany. Germany's a dangerous country. Germany's a blackmailer. Germany's a semi-criminal country. But the important thing to note is that the Germans are now coming to think of Britain as their chief enemy. You know, what a dramatic change from the 1890s, from natural allies to natural enemies. Britain is the heart of this anti-German bloc. And so what is the German response to all of this? The German response to all of it is to try and mend fences with Russia. After all, Russia is one of Britain's principal adversaries. You know, Russia was kind of betrayed by her own ally, France, right? Because as Russia is fighting Britain's ally, Japan, France goes and makes this deal with Japan's ally, Britain. It's like, well, doesn't this mean that maybe you can get Russia to kind of move over to the side of Germany? They could drive a wedge into the Franco-Russian alliance? Well, and there's this meeting. I forgot to put this here. At Bjorko. Bjorko is in is in the Baltic near Finland. Or the meeting took place near Bjorko, in the Baltic, between the Kaiser and the Tsar in 1905, while the Russo-Japanese War was actually going on. And the Kaiser pulls out of his pocket the text of the treaty between Russia and Germany, and it gets the Tsar to sign. And it's only when the Tsar returns to St. Petersburg and his ministers tell him, look, you can't do this, given our obligations to France, that the Russians basically renege on the treaty, right? But the Russians don't basically slam the door in the Germans' face. They say, look, what we got to do, we approve of the idea of coming together against Britain, but we have a close political relationship and also financial relationship with France, and for us to have a decent relationship with you, you have to kind of mend fences for France. You got to do what's necessary to bring France into the continental bloc. Right? This is like the kind of thinking that provides the background for the first Moroccan crisis. Because how can you get the French to move toward a decent relationship with Germany? And the answer was, well, you make them see how much a decent relationship with Germany is worth to them by dramatizing to them the consequences of their failure to have a decent relationship with Germany. Right? And you do that by taking a stand on some issue which is of fundamental political importance to them, to show you that they got that they're paying a price for not squaring things with you, for not, you know, treating you the way you should be treated. And the whole idea was, you know, you may have a crisis if you put down your foot in that way, but the crisis could pave the way toward a future reconciliation. And they looked at Fashoda. The relationship between the Fashoda crisis between Britain and France in 1898, and then just 6 years later, you have the Anglo-French Entente. The French realized that they couldn't, you know, treat Britain the way they had been treating, and then they basically were willing to, you know, work out a deal with the British. You know, you could do these sorts of things. It was the same French foreign minister, Delcasse, the foreign minister at the time of Fashoda, who negotiated the Anglo-French Entente. It wasn't as though there was a change in government, a change in attitude. It was a structural change. Okay. So that's the background of the first Moroccan crisis. The Germans don't want a war with France. They want a political settlement with France. But the way to achieve this political settlement is they first have to show the French that they need it, that they pay a price for not having it. And what is the price? The frustration of French ambitions in Morocco. So the Kaiser goes down to the Moroccan city of Tangier, and he gives the speech there, and he gets a little carried away, and he says that Germany supports the whole principle of the independence and territorial integrity of Morocco. French are very upset. You know, the Germans are going to block their ambitions. And so they had not consulted the Germans when they had opted for a policy of trying to take over Morocco. They had made deals with everyone else. They had made deals with the British over Egypt, with Spain over the northern strip of Morocco, with Italy over what was to become Libya. You know, they make deals with everyone else, but not with the Germans. A policy which upset some of the professionals in the French Foreign Office. Right? So Germans, you know, people point to the first Moroccan crisis, evidence of German aggressiveness. Was it? You know, see, the Germans said, you know, it was the French that were violating the independence of Morocco. This was, they were not behaving in a way that was consonant with international law, because the Act of Madrid of 1880 had guaranteed the independence of Morocco. Plus, the Germans are in a very strong position militarily at this point. You know, this is mainly because France's main continental ally, Russia, was in no position to risk a war. You know, having suffered all these military reverses at the hands of Japan, reverses which, by the way, had led to, you know, significant turmoil within Russia itself, to this revolution of 1905 within Russia. Right? Plus, France is in no position to stand up to Germany because the French military position is particularly weak at this point. This is the period of the Dreyfus Affair, where it's the whole status of the French military that's in question. France is like torn apart by all of this. War breaks out. The Germans will win it hands down. They don't want a war, you see? They want a negotiated settlement with the French. Anyway, the French are now quite scared. And the prime minister's name is Rouvier. He approaches the Germans, basically says, "What do you want? What are your terms? Let's reach a settlement." And the Germans say no, with the argument that, we can't just make a deal. This whole business of Morocco had been guaranteed by the powers at a conference. If we're going to settle the Moroccan thing, it has to be at a conference of the powers. Right? And the German political calculation is the conference of the powers, their legal position is so strong that the French can never, you know, get a majority there. And they don't want to simply lay down the law to France because that would create too much bitterness. But if a decision was laid down by the powers as a bloc, then there would be less bitterness on the part of France, and you could pave the way toward the reconciliation with Germany, drawing France into this continental bloc against Britain. Right? You know, and the French finally agreed to this. And a conference is in fact held at the Spanish city of Algeciras, which is just very very close to Gibraltar, right across the Straits of Gibraltar from northern Morocco. But the Germans had utterly failed to make any preliminary soundings and prepare for the success of this sort of policy. And one after the other, all the powers basically take the French side, and Germany's the one who's isolated, right? Because France had made deals with the British, with the Italians, and so on. And even the United States, Theodore Roosevelt felt, who was president there at Algeciras, felt that the Germans were bullying France, and so on. Right? So it's Germany who's isolated now. What are the Germans to do? Right? Are they simply to turn their backs on this whole arrangement that they themselves have championed? Right? And in fact, the German government is divided and doesn't quite know what sort of policy to pursue. There are three distinct strands of policy. One is, you know, a policy of, you know, if the French don't accede, well, then there will be a war. You will use force. You can't have diplomacy if you rule out the risk of war. It's not like a war is desired as an end in itself, but once you rule out the use of force, then your diplomacy carries no weight, right? Then there's the view that, oh, well, a war with France is utterly out of the question because that's the last thing that the Germans want. They want a reconciliation with France. The whole point of the strategy was to draw France into a decent relationship with Germany, form a continental bloc against Britain. And then there was a third group that took the colonial goal of transforming Morocco into a German colony seriously. These different strands of policy are not coordinated, they're not synchronized, core policy decisions aren't made. So the Germans have this choice that they have to make. So what will they do? Should they, you know, just, you know, pick up all their marbles and go home and say, no, this is unacceptable? you know, we're not going to accept this new arrangement that favored the French, that the majority of the powers represented at Algeciras favored. No, they accede to it because they don't want a war. And the French sense that the Germans had ruled out a war, this enabled them to really push the Germans against the wall. Story is quite interesting. It's interesting because of the light it throws on one of the core issues of international politics, this whole question of aggression. How do you understand conflict like the First World War? And a lot of people say, oh, it's to be understood as a war of German aggression. It's the climax of this aggressive policy that the Germans had been pursuing, for a decade. It was look at the first Moroccan crisis. Germany's to blame. Germany's the aggressor there. Germany's the one that provoked it, and so on. Was Germany the aggressor? Right. Who was trying to take over an independent country? Not Germany, it was France. Who was the one who was violating international law? Not Germany, it was France, right? Who's the aggressor? France, sensing that Germany ruled out war, sought to humiliate Germany, press her advantage, get everything that she wanted, and give the Germans nothing. Germany had not been accommodated. Germany had been treated with contempt. And this in spite of the fact that Germany was such a strong country and was in such a favorable military position in 1905, 1906. Right? But when push comes to shove, Germany prefers to a diplomatic defeat, a humiliation of the sort, to actually plunging into war. Even though the outcome of a war at this point would have been quite clear. This would not have been a difficult war for Germany to fight. Okay? So bearing all that stuff in mind, who's the aggressor? It's very hard, often, when you kind of look at these great episodes in international politics, to say, this side is the aggressor, this side is the victim. You know, in political science literature, you have a lot of articles and books that assume that these decisions can be made very simply. You know, who started the war? Who is the victim? But it's not to be understood in such simple terms. It's an important conclusion. Far more important is that is understanding the effect that all of this had on the structure of European politics in this period. Because Britain sided with France, not just that it sided with France during this crisis, but actually pushed the French forward. And the British were quite upset when it seemed that France and Germany might reach a private understanding to settle the crisis. And the British attitude upset the French. What were the political consequences of the first Moroccan crisis? Right? Very important, because this was one of the key events that drove the wedge deep between Germany and the Western powers. You can understand, let's say, the British policy of supporting France and Morocco if the British had said to the French, we'll support you, but you really should try and square things with the Germans. The Germans are an important country. You don't want to burn your bridges with the Germans. The British themselves, you'd think, would have said, we don't want to burn our bridges with the Germans. Why? Because you don't want a war. You don't want the Germans to feel they have no stake in the status quo. Plus, the worse your relations are with Germany, the more dependent you are on Russia. That's a point that applies to Britain, and this is a point that applies to France. The more you to use that metaphor that Salisbury used in that article he wrote about the war of about the Franco-Prussian War, you know? It's like when people are carried away by emotion, they actually get satisfaction from the humiliation of their adversaries, you know, from burning the iron deep into the adversary's soul. But that doesn't make sense politically. That is not a rational political position to pursue, right? People like Salisbury had no love for the Germans. But their view was cold and calculating, saying, the worse relations are with Germany, the more dependent we'll be on Germany's continental adversaries. The more dependent we'll be on Russia, on France. The more compromised our policies will be. The more limited our freedom of action will be. Because the worse the relationship was between Germany and the Western powers, the more Russia would profit from that. If Germany views, you know, Britain as a principal adversary, the more she's going to want to accommodate Russia, to kind of draw Russia away from Britain. You know? Or from the Western powers in general, right? The worst relations are between the Western powers, Britain and France, and Germany, the more Britain and France are going to want to make sure that Russia is on their side. You understand? The worse relations are between Germany and the West, the better position Russia's going to be in. There's going to be a competition for Russian favor. See, this is the really important consequence of the worsening of relations between Germany and the West that's symbolized by the first Moroccan crisis, right? It empowers Russia. And Russia is not a status quo country. There's a competition for Russian favor in this decade before the First World War, right? It's not an accident that Russia is able to pursue a forward policy in the Balkans during this period, right? And the empowerment of Russia is going to be an enormous source of instability, right? Was the policy that Britain and France pursued vis-a-vis Germany during this period to be understood in rational power political terms? You know, if you can make that case, you could say that a system based on power is inherently unstable. But no, Britain and France had a power political interest in not alienating Germany in that way. Not because there was any great love for the Germans, but because they had an interest in not empowering Russia, in constraining Russia, right? The interest of the Western powers throughout the 20th century, right? First Britain and France, and then America as well, was in balancing between Germany and Russia. You don't want either of those two countries to be too strong, and you don't want either of those countries to be too weak, because you want to use them as counterweights against each other. That's the rational power political policy, right? But when you allow yourself to be carried away by emotion, in the case of the British, by this anti-German emotion that you can see in documents like the Croke Memorandum, then you're going to pay a price for that in power political terms. The troubles that we're going to see developing in Europe during this period before 1914 are not a natural working out of a system based on power, not the result of policies that are rational in power political terms, that respond to the imperatives of a system based on power. Quite the contrary. You know, I talked about this in the case of Germany. It doesn't make sense for Germany to alienate the next three most important powers in Europe all at the same time. It's not in Germany's interest. And this policy pursued by Britain and France are really pushing the Germans against the wall. That's not in the interest of those countries. And none of these policies are in the interest of the system as a whole. Okay, next time, the triple entente. Oh, also, those of you who weren't here last time, you want to pick up your paper, your midterm, it's up here in alphabetical order.